Gentlemen, with that gavel, I have just convened the Subcommittee on Transportation and Economic Development for February the 16th, 2016. We are gathered here today for the purpose of a work session on the Department of Aviation fee ratifications and Department of Transportation Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration grant application, the Oregon Business Development Department Seismic Rehabilitation Grant Program administrative funding, and Senate Bill 1512 relating to seismic rehabilitation, and an informational hearing on Oregon Business Development Department SOAR, the unmanned aerial vehicle status report. So with that, Ms. Naburka, I will open a work session on the Department of Aviation, and will you give us an introduction?
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair and committee members. Our first two items will be two fee ratifications for the Department of Aviation, one for tie-down fees at state-owned airports and one for unmanned aerial systems that are operated by public agencies. Mitch Schwecker from the Department of Aviation is here to tell you about these two items.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Schwecker.
Good afternoon, Chair Johnson, Co-Chairs Johnson and Gomberg, members of the committee. Mitch Schwecker, the Director of the Oregon Department of Aviation. I'm here for two very simple things, fee ratifications on two fees that we've processed through the DAS administrative process. One is we rent tie-downs at state-owned airports to FBOs, and in the past we've leased them at 30% of what they collect. Well, they don't very often collect anything, so we collect 30% of nothing. So what we're doing is imposing a flat $10 fee, which is below the market rate that they could charge, so that when they lease them from us at $10, they can then release them if they so choose, and it's optional for them. They can so choose. They can rent them at whatever the prevailing rate at their airport is. For us, it would be about $17.50 per tie-down. The second fee is in the legislature 2013. We passed House Bill 2710, which requires us to begin registering unmanned aircraft systems, drones, starting in January of 2016. This is a fee ratification for the fee imposed by that piece of legislation. What we have is a fee to propose a very broad brush, $25 for those 55 pounds and below, which is the FAA breakpoint, and then $50 for those 55 pounds and above. And we've worked closely with a drone working group to come to this price. We had it at a slightly higher rate, Oregon State University, which is a number of unmanned aircraft systems, asked that we not charge quite so much. So we reduced it and made it a flat fee across the board. And subject to any question, that concludes my ask.
Thank you very much. Colleagues, before I go to Co-Chair Gomberg, I want it noted for the record that Senator Hansel is excused. He's testifying on a bill, and I presume he will be joining us as soon as he's done. Representative Gomberg.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. And real quickly, forgive my ignorance on this, but typically how many tie-downs are used on an aircraft?
Usually three tie-downs, and at a number of our airports, state-owned airports, we have 15 or 20 tie-down locations. There would be a three-point tie-down at each location.
So we're talking about a $30 fee?
No,
typically.
Just for the tie-down itself would be a $10 fee.
So when we say tie-down, we mean tie-downs?
The site okay. Of the tie-downs. There are three chains that are attached.
Got it.
That constitute one tie-down.
Sorry, my the kind of aircraft I'm familiar with have strings attached, and they go in a bag at the end of the day. So
I'm familiar.
I would that were true in aviation. Any other questions? Great. I think you've done a good job explaining it. Ms. Naburka, do you have a LFO recommendation?
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. The Legislative Fiscal Office recommends that the fees adopted by the Department of Aviation be included in a fee ratification bill during the 2016 legislative session.
Thank you. Colleagues, you've heard we better hear from the Chief Financial Officer. Sorry.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. And members of the committee. I'm Linnea Whittakin with the DAS Chief Financial Office, and we approve the request.
Thank you very much. Co-Chair Gomberg.
Madam Co-Chair, now that I'm a tie-down expert, I'd be happy to move the recommendation.
Thank you. Co-Chair Gomberg has moved the LFO recommendation with respect to the Department of Aviation fee ratifications. Any questions? Any discussion? Any objections? So ordered. Thank you, Mr. Schwecker. We will now close the work session on the Department of Aviation, open a work session on the Department of Transportation, Motor Carrier Safety Administration,
Did you need a carrier on that last
one? We don't need a carrier on that one. It'll go in, as correct me if I'm wrong, it'll go into the big omnibus reconciliation bill. I think we're going to need a carrier on this one, though. Mr. McClelland, I'm going to ask Ms. Nabucco to make some opening comments, and then we'll move to you.
Oh, thank you, Madam Co-Chair. The next item is a request from the Department of Transportation to apply for about a $1.1 million grant from the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration. And Tom McClelland from the Department of Transportation is here to tell you more about that.
Mr. McClelland, welcome.
Co-Chair Johnson, members of the committee, my name is Tom McClelland, DMV Administrator with the Department of Transportation. I am here to request your approval to apply for a federal grant of $1,106,811 to comply with federal commercial driver license regulations. I will say there's no state match attached with this. This would be pure federal funds that we'd be applying for. FMCSA, the federal agency, has published regulations in April of 2015 with an effective date of June 22, 2018. The purpose is to streamline the medical examination process for holders of commercial driver licenses and commercial learner permits. Instead of drivers presenting their medical examination card to us, the data will be submitted to a database that the federal agency is creating, where the medical examiners will submit the information electronically, and then that information will be available to us for driver license purposes. Currently, the person has to provide that every 2 years to us, and so it'll be an electronic process that they're moving toward. Non-compliance with these types of federal regulations could cost us up to 10% of federal aid highway funds, approximately $48 million in last year. And also the ability to issue commercial driver licenses in Oregon. That is a federal program. In order for us to continue to issue commercial driver licenses, we must comply with those regulations. The types of work that we envision for this, all computer programming type work, regulations that will have to, rules will have to change, but mostly commercial computer programming changes. There is a legislative concept under development for the 2017 session, which we will be bringing forward to you next session, that goes along with this work. The federal money is available now, has a closing date in April, and I believe we'd be somewhat negligent not to go after that federal money if they're offering it to us to comply with their own regulations. So we are requesting your approval to apply.
Thank you. Representative Woodson.
Since I'm not familiar with what is required for the medical, it's going to go into a national database, is that correct?
Yes, it is.
So is it going to contain fingerprints and blood types, or what exactly is going into this, and how long does it stay? Only as long as the license, and then how do they dispose of, I mean, that's a pretty big database.
Yeah. Co-Chair Johnson, Representative Whitsitt. This is information that there is no personal identifiable information in what they are providing. So it's information like who is the physician, codes that identify that medical examiner, telephone number, the issue date of the exam that was done. It's more determining whether there ought to be any restrictions placed on the person's driving permissions, privileges, not the actual medical examination. There's no medical information that's actually sent to the federal database. I think that addresses your question.
Yes, if I may. I guess I'm not understanding the point of it. If you don't identify the driver that this goes with, what is the point of having a database then?
There is a connection to the driver. We can identify which individual it was. But I was just trying to indicate that there is no medical examination, no HIPAA-type information that would be involved with this.
Excuse me, but I still don't understand. If there's no HIPAA information, what is the point of this then? If the person has something that says that they shouldn't drive, then they shouldn't get the license. I'm not understanding. I'm sorry.
Co-Chair Johnson, Representative Whitsitt, it's just the information that's on the card today, which maybe I could have brought an example for you, but there's no medical information on it. It's just indicating who the person is, that they've complied with the examination that they had to have, that physical exam that had to be done, and that they passed it, and that they are eligible to operate a commercial vehicle.
Maybe I can. Would the point of the story be if I'm a commercial truck driver and I have all my paperwork in order, I pass the medical, I get stopped by a trooper. A trooper then can look on this database and see that Betsy Johnson has passed the medical that is required to carry a commercial driver's license.
Yes, Co-Chair. Either they're checking that database or checking ours to see if we have a record of it being recorded. But yes, that's
and the benefit to me is that it all happens electronically behind the scenes, and I don't have to get the paperwork from my doctor, trudge it down to DMV, submit it to you guys with the possibility that it gets lost. I've dealt with casework where exactly that scenario has played out. So this is seamless evidence that I have complied with having a commercial driver's license.
Yes, that is true.
And failure to do so costs us $48 million and compels us to no longer issue CDLs.
Yes, that's true.
That's a pretty compelling reason to pass the grant request.
Hence, I am here.
Any other questions for Mr. McClellan? Okay. I've got one for you, completely off topic, but you're a target of opportunity. We have had this same conversation about loss of federal money and our ability to perform certain tasks if we don't do certain things, and the legislature has risen to that call. I understand that our driver's licenses, our Oregon driver's licenses, will no longer be acceptable in October of 2016 for the purposes of boarding domestic or international flights. Is that true? And if it is, what are you all doing to fix that?
Co-Chair Johnson, what you're referring to is the Federal Real ID Act. There is a requirement that states comply with approximately 35, 36 different regulations. We comply with most of those. We're currently in a one-year deferral of enforcement period because of the progress that has been made in Oregon. That expires in October. It does not affect access to commercial planes through TSA until 2018. So there's a period of time that if we don't get another extension, there'd be a period of time there where our cards would still be accepted at airports, but possibly not at nuclear power plants, military bases, some federal buildings as a result of that. There's no federal money that we would lose. There's no penalty in that regard for noncompliance. It purely is that the cards would not be accepted at certain federal facilities.
I'm thinking of our colleagues and fellow Oregonians that work at Hanford. I presume that they could be not allowed onto the Hanford Reservation if we don't get this fixed?
Co-Chair Johnson, that is a possibility. You have to go back to the 2009 legislative session, where it was the last time the legislature took up this issue. There was a bill passed at that time, Senate Bill 536, which put limits on what state agencies could do to try to comply with the federal law. Requires that federal funds be available, appropriated for this purpose, and that certain confidentiality be assured in whatever systems that we would develop for this. So the current public policy position of the legislature is that we would only comply if federal funds were provided and some other provisions were met.
I'm just going to make this editorial comment. That sort of smacks of blame the victim. And I would at least like to put Ms. Naburka on notice that I may be seeking a budget note to make sure that remedying this sticks, that you guys present some kind of a plan to the 17th session so that our driver's licenses have the integrity of being able to get us onto these federal reservations and onto aircraft. Representative Nierman.
Thank you, Chair Johnson. So I have in my hot little hands here a copy of 2009 Senate Bill 536.
You need a life, Representative, if you're dragging that around.
Anyway, I intend to introduce some legislation in the 2017 session to deal with some of these issues, namely the inability of the state to use state funds to solve this project. And there's some security concerns too, which are legitimate, but I think there are solvable issues there. So this kind of came to my attention when I was on the IT as a member of the IT committee, because we have the hood open right now, and it'd be a good time to resolve some of these issues.
Great.
So I'm on board with you. I'll look for you to be a co-sponsor of this.
Well, let's not chew up any more time. You came to it through the IT committee. I came through it through Capital Gossip. So it looks like we're both headed in the same direction. Mm-hmm. Any other questions of Mr. McClelland with respect to this federal grant application? Ms. Naburka, you have a recommendation?
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. The Legislative Fiscal Office recommends approval of the request. If this grant is awarded, ODOT may return to the legislature with a request for additional federal funds expenditure limitation.
Thank you. And the Chief Financial Office?
Yes, Madam Co-Chair and members of the committee, Linnea Wittekin with the DAS Chief Financial Office, and we recommend approval of the request.
Thank you. Representative Gomberg.
Yes, Madam Co-Chair, I recommend approval of the recommendation.
Thank you. Colleagues, you've heard Co-Chair Gomberg's motion. Any questions? Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Thank you, Mr. McClelland. And we do need a carrier for this one. We got any volunteers? Senator Monroe steps up and volunteers. Thank you. All right. Close the work session on the Department of Transportation's Federal Motor Carrier Grant Request. Open a work session on Oregon Business Development Department Seismic Rehabilitation Grant Program Administrative Funding. Welcome, gentlemen. Sign in, please. And Co-Chair Gomberg, can I give you that for just a second?
Welcome, Mr. Bender. Did you want to give us a little background before we get started here?
Certainly, Mr. Co-Chair and subcommittee members. The Oregon Business Development Department operates the Seismic Rehabilitation Grant Program. That is the program that provides grants for seismic rehabilitation of public school and emergency services facilities. The legislature significantly expanded this grant program in the 2015 session from $30 million in the last session to $205 million this session. The Oregon Business Development Department is before you today to request $260,514 in lottery funds and two limited duration positions for assistance in administering the program at its expanded levels of activities.
Thank you so much. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you, Co-Chair Gomberg, committee members. My name is Robert Ault. I am the Interim Assistant Director of Business Oregon's Infrastructure Finance Authority. If I may, I would just take a couple of minutes and give you a little background and history of the program. The program moved from the Oregon Military Department to Business Oregon in January of 2014. Originally, we had $30 million in grant funding through 2013-15. That is currently under contract, and the projects are underway. That includes 22 school projects and 13 emergency service facilities. A little bit about how it works. We can fund K through 12 educational facilities, community colleges, and emergency services buildings. The projects must be rehabilitation, not new construction, and must be outside a tsunami zone. The legislature named a committee to select those projects, and that selection includes a benefit cost analysis, community impact, geographic diversity, and also historic preservation. One of the projects that we're particularly fond of and proud of is the gymnasium in Roseburg. I think the community as well is very proud of what we've accomplished with the program. As Mr. Bender said, we do have $205 million in 15-17 for grant funding provided for the program. That includes a $50 million bond sale this spring. We closed the application period December 31st. We have 107 applications for $123 million in funding requests for that $50 million that is available. There's a $155 million bond sale planned for 2017.
Let me just stop you right there. Bullet number three is the most important piece of this whole conversation, and that is you way oversubscribed, and what is your filter for deciding what the successful applicants are that move forward? Do you have objective criteria that are easily understandable for the legislature? Can you come back and double dip? What's the compelling argument? Is there a required match? Are you ready to go? Are you going to get sued by some environmental group? What's the filter?
Co-Chair Gomberg, Senator Johnson, and committee members, we do have an extensive filter, it includes a benefit cost analysis that is administered. There is a committee that is, was appointed by the legislature that does walk through and rate the projects. We
say that again. Who walks through and rates the?
There's a seismic advisory committee appointed by the legislature that will go through and look at the projects and rate them, and those projects will be funded. The projects that were not funded for this round can roll over into the next round of funding.
We've been very cranky on Connect Oregon, for example, that any of the decision makers in terms of ranking the projects don't have a project in the hunt. Are you employing that same level of rigor?
Co-chair Gomberg and Johnson, committee members, yes, we are. I think it's very important that we make sure that there is no conflict of interest there.
And so do they just recuse themselves, or are they not part of the panel, or?
Anyone who would have a direct connection to that project would be required to recuse themselves.
I would just suggest to you, Connect's gone a little more aggressively forward than that. Recusal isn't enough. They're disallowed to sit on the committee.
We will indeed follow the most stringent measures that we can and we employ that as well.
Are those 107 applications up for public review anywhere?
No, they're not at this point.
When will they be? Let's call a lifeline. If you'd introduce yourself, please.
Senator Johnson, Representative Gomberg, members of the committee, my name is Gloria Zacharias, and I am the program and policy coordinator for the Seismic Rehabilitation Program. And at this point, anyone could come in and review the applications. Right now, they're being reviewed by an outside consultant, myself, and a part-time employee. At such time, they go to the committee reviews them. And we're anticipating that to happen in the middle of March.
Senator Representative Whitsitt.
So we're doing a seismic rehabilitation retrofit, basically. Is this correct, what you're bonding for?
Yes.
Of schools?
Of schools and emergency service facilities.
So what standard are you going for, the uniform commercial building code, a 7 seismic event, or what? What is your standard that you are having as the baseline for
Senator Johnson, Representative Gomberg, members of the committee, Representative Whitsitt? The schools are required to meet life safety standards, which is from the Uniform Act, and the emergency services buildings are required to meet immediate occupancy standards, and those are all at a level 9, I believe, a shaking 9 earthquake.
I'd like to see that. I'd like to see what you are retrofitting to withstand a 9. Thank you.
Representative Reed.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I was just looking on your website for the list of the membership of the advisory committee, and perhaps all the other committee members know this, but it's interesting there's members from the Office of Emergency Management, DOGAMI, Seismic Safety Policy Advisory Commission, DAS, Department of Education, the Health Authority, Fire Chiefs Association, Association of Chiefs of Police, Association of Hospitals and Health Systems, and the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators. My question, if you could give us a little more detail about the process. I understand Representative Witz's question, but there's likely more, clearly there's more demand than capacity. Are you going to take the most severe example that might take up a greater proportion of the dollars, or are you going to try to spread that and do more projects that are going to affect a number of people? Can you talk some more about the dynamics you're using, please?
Certainly, Chair Gomberg, Co-Chair Johnson, committee members, there is a cap of $1.5 million per project, which helps spread that. We also will look closely at the benefit-cost analysis that is done. We will look at a geographic diversity so that there is projects done throughout the state.
Historic.
And also historic preservation aspects and community impact.
Okay. Thank you.
I'm confused by that. Historic preservation impacts. Tell me we're not going to seismically retrofit brick buildings.
No. Can you elaborate?
Certainly. Senator Johnson, Representative Gomberg, members of the committee, historic consideration is built into the benefit cost analysis tool, and it does consider if it's a historic building that is already listed as a historic building. And yes, ma'am, some of the buildings that are retrofitted are brick buildings. It's called unreinforced masonry. And there are specific guidelines in the structural codes that they have to do certain things to reinforce those buildings.
I know that there is a PhD geologist sitting on this panel, and I would just be quite curious. I would be quite curious to know whether or not a brick building can withstand a 9.
Right. I've never heard of an already existing building. You can build them to that standard, but it is extremely rare to retrofit something to a 9.
And Chair Gomberg, Co-Chair Johnson, will certainly provide all the information that you request if we can't answer the question today.
Okay, let's move forward. I've gotten us stuck where there's no mud, so let's keep going.
The map shows a geographic distribution of the projects throughout the state. And concretely why we're here today, we are requesting 260.
Could you go back to that for just a second? Does that geographic distribution tell you anything about how adequate the notice was, or are you informed at all by that geographic distribution?
I think the information that we gather from that geographic distribution is certainly that the seismic the risk of it, of major damage from a seismic event along the coast is substantial. We are sensitive to the fact that there's a large gray area in there. We're doing substantial outreach to make sure that all of the state, throughout the state, that they're aware of this opportunity.
Okay. Representative Reed.
Thank you, Mayor Co-Chair. Just one clarification point. We have $50 million in available funds. That's prior to the next sale. That number goes up, yes?
That's correct.
Thank you.
Okay, please continue.
As I mentioned, we are requesting $260,514 in lottery funds, allocation, and expenditure limitation. We'd like to establish two limited duration positions for the Seismic Rehabilitation Grant Program. The request includes $140,000 in personnel services, $100,000 in professional services, and $20,000 in services and supplies.
That's in addition to the outside consultant and the part-time employee, or is this how we're paying for the outside consultant and the part-time employee?
Co-Chair Johnson, Co-Chair Gomberg, committee members, this is how we would be financing that.
But the work's already underway.
Yes. In part, we have used lottery funds in the past to finance some of this.
Okay. Is that the totality of your presentation?
Yes, I'd be happy to answer any further questions, but that is the presentation.
Colleagues, any additional questions? Co-Chair Gomberg.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I heard you say earlier that this would not apply to any projects within the tsunami inundation zone. Is that correct?
Co-Chair Gomberg, committee members, that is correct.
And do you think that may have had any effect on the two counties along the coast that were in the gray rather than the blue area?
Yes, I would think that would have effect.
All right, colleagues, any other questions? Representative Witt.
Just a comment, Madam Chair, and I recognize the agencies don't necessarily get to choose what projects are assigned to them, but I somehow fail to see how this fits this agency's basic mission. And given the list of board members that Representative Reed read off, it seems like there may be other agencies that might be better suited to fulfill this mission, which is not a criticism of the job that Business Oregon is doing, but rather It just seems one of the oddest fits I've heard about this session.
May I respond to you? They got stuck with it.
Yeah, I was just wondering who angered someone. There's probably more.
There's a large backstory, but these guys ended up with the short straw when everything was said and done.
Uh-huh. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Reed will fill you in on the backstory. Hey. Any other questions of the agency? Mr. Bender, do you have a recommendation?
We do. The Legislative Fiscal Office is recommending in favor of the request with a small modification. We do note that the level of activity in the program is expanding significantly. The program was able to fund approximately 35 projects last biennium. Of course, they received more applications. They had to review more applications than that, but there were 35 funded programs. And we're expecting that number to increase to about 160 or more in the current biennium. In order to provide proper management of these expanded level of activity, we do recommend approving the request. We do note that the agency indicated that they would need the additional two positions for a three-year period that started before the bonds were issued to help assist in reviewing the applications to after the bond proceeds had been distributed, but the projects were being monitored for compliance. They had asked for the positions on a limited duration basis. We are recommending that you approve the request for inclusion in the 2016 session budget reconciliation bill, but establish the positions as permanent positions with the understanding the department will include a policy option package in its 2017-19 biennium request budget to convert the positions to limited duration. The reason for this modification is if you approve these positions as limited duration, they will expire on June 30th of 2017. When the agency goes out to recruit for the positions, they will need to inform potential applicants of that fact. The recommendation, modified recommendation, if you choose to adopt it, would allow the agency to recruit with informing applicants that there is an expectation that the positions will exist for 3 years. We're doing this in order to potentially improve the applicant pool and to get more qualified applicants interested. What would happen is, again, the agency will present a policy option package to eliminate these positions, which presumably will be adopted unless, again, there is a large bond issue approved, then you may want to review that. But if, assuming that the activity levels go back to historic levels and this is a one-time bump up, we think that that minor modification will assist the agency in getting a broader applicant pool for these important positions.
Representative Woodson.
So what are the requirements going to be for the background of the people there? I mean, I would suggest that they be an engineer and a geologist, frankly, because they will be the best people to administer the grant program. I mean, you can find people like that, but I think you need to be very, very careful that you don't just get an accountant or something to do this. You need two professional individuals that are engineers or an engineer and a geologist to do that, in my opinion.
Representative Gomberg, Chair Gomberg and Johnson, committee members, we will do our utmost to make sure that we have qualified staff to administer the program. We're very aware of the fact that we have to do our due diligence and make sure that we're funding up the correct projects that will succeed.
Is a list of the projects completed to date anywhere?
Yes, there is a list of project and applications that we currently have.
No, the 35 that are completed.
Chair Gomberg, Co-Chair Johnson, we do have a list of projects that are underway or complete.
Okay. Thank you. Is it on the agency's website?
There, if I
Mr. Bender.
There actually is an item in today's OLA subcommittee. The item is identified or as labeled OBDD seismic selection process. That item does on page, let's see, I had it here, lists awards on page 4 and 5.
Thank you.
Or, yes, 4 and 5 indicates those awards, the 35 items awarded, the projects funded in the prior biennium budget.
Okay. Thank you. That's very helpful. Would you? Okay. So we've heard Mr. Bender's recommendation, Chief Financial Officer.
Good afternoon, Co-Chairs Johnson and Gunberg, members of the committee. My name is Patrick Heath with the Chief Financial Office. We recommend approving the agency's request.
Okay, so the two recommendations, colleagues, differ. I would entertain a motion for the LFO.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair, and I would move the LFO recommendation.
Thank you very much. Colleagues, you have heard Chair Gunberg's motion. Any questions? Any discussion? Any objection?
I would like to vote no on that.
Okay.
I will, too.
Okay. The record will reflect Representative Nierman and Representative Whitsitt voting no. The LFO request is approved, or the LFO recommendation is approved. And will we need carriers for this?
No, we will go ahead and include this in the budget reconciliation bill based on the vote of this, today's vote of this.
Okay, great. So I'll close the work session on Oregon Business Development Department Seismic Rehabilitation Grant Program Administrative Funding, and I will open a work session on Senate Bill 1512 relating to seismic rehabilitation. And Mr. Bender, would you give us an introduction to the issue?
Senate Bill 1512 is a policy bill relating to seismic rehabilitation bonds. In OLIS's listing of materials for today's subcommittee meeting, these are located at the bottom, the last two items. So if you don't see them initially, please scroll down. There's a preliminary SMS and an item which is the LFO recommendation. I am basically going to be speaking from that recommendation. What this bill does is additional items that are available to you include a fiscal impact statement on OLIS. Senate Bill 1512 was reported out of the Senate Committee on Veterans and Emergency Preparedness on February 3rd and referred to Ways and Means by prior reference. The bill specifies that the proceeds of the general obligation bonds which are issued to support the Seismic Rehabilitation Grant Program may be used to pay for surveying and engineering evaluations and to pay agency program administrative costs. That is to say, this bill expands the potential uses of the bonds that are issued to support the grants of the program that you were just discussing to also cover administrative expenses. Currently, all of these expenses are covered by lottery funds, and by vote of the subcommittee, additional lottery funds are being provided to provide for administration of the program during the current biennium as activity expands. If Senate Bill 1512 is enacted in the future, the agency would have the opportunity to request that some of the administrative costs of this program be financed not from lottery funds, but from a portion of the proceeds of the bonds themselves. In these cases, expands the potential fund sources of administering this program in the future. Other general obligation bonds issued under Article 11Q have been used to pay agency program administrative costs also in some instances. This bill would allow potentially the seismic program to be administered in the same manner. But the co-chair's budget does not anticipate using this provision in the current biennium. The current biennium will continue to fully fund the administrative costs with lottery funds. LFO does not recommend amending the bill, Be happy to answer any questions.
I've got one for you. What are the brakes on the agency's ability to lard up administrative costs? Sorry, I can't think of a better word. Sorry, guys.
The administrative costs for the agency would continue to be subject to legislative review and approved in the budget. So, for example, requests for additional positions, such as you have today, or other associated costs, would need to be funded in the budget. That process would not change. It would be a different fund source that could potentially be used to pay for those. Of course, to the extent that lottery bond proceeds are used for administrative costs instead of grants, that would reduce the amount available for grants under any given lottery bond issuance amount. But this would be an option, and we do not know if the department would even use this in the future or not.
One more. I would assume that as the projects are coming forward, and maybe I'd ask the agency to come back up here, I would assume that as a project comes forward for the ABC grade school, that ABC grade school has done some of the due diligence on their nickel to ascertain the feasibility of doing a project. True or false?
I believe that is true, that the applicants do already have in place an engineer, that a feasibility study is in place. There's a rudimentary assessment of the ability of the project to be successful.
Okay, so does this now pave the way for ABC School and other similarly situated schools to come with no conception of the feasibility of doing a project and asking the agency to provide evaluation or seismic assays? Or what I'm trying to figure out is to what degree do the projects come to you fairly fully formed versus using this bill as a pathway to do their rudimentary due diligence?
It's my understanding of the intent, the co-chair, Gomberg, co-chair Johnson, and committee members, was to have the flexibility to fund the internal administrative staff and some engineering expenses, but it wouldn't change the basics of the program that cause the due diligence of the applicant to be done before they come in. So,
okay. Representative Whitsitt.
So is there a limit, say school ABC gets one of these grants that is based on, I'm just trying to understand, on a bond that says you can't exceed 10% for the surveying and engineering evaluation? Or could they come in and say, well, you know, we spent 90% of the money on that and we never got around to spending the money to actually retrofitting the school? Is there a limit, or do you have it divided up somehow?
Co-chairs Gomberg, co-chair Johnson, committee members, I believe all of those limits would still apply for engineering or feasibility studies, so that they couldn't exceed those maximums, allowing the project to be done, if I understand your question.
But you don't have a limit on, is it 10%? Is it 30%?
If you'd introduce yourself for the record.
My name is Gloria Zacharias, and I am the Program and Policy Coordinator for the Seismic Rehabilitation Grant Program. Senator Johnson, Representative Gomberg, members of the committee, Representative Whitsitt, while there is not a limit, if the project is not completed and signed off at the end of the construction project, they have to pay the money back. If the school is not signed off as brought by their engineer, as brought up to life safety, or by their, you know, prime contractor, or if it's not brought up to immediate occupancy, if you're an emergency services building, then they would have to pay the money back. We, in the advisory committee, has been asked if they would like to put a limit on it, and at this point, they feel reasonable.
And so what's in the rules is it says reasonable engineering and architectural. And if it's all right, I'd like to answer your question about the feasibility studies. As part of the application process, they have to have an engineering feasibility study on the building already completed, and it comes in with the application. So we do not pay for those. That is paid for by either the school district or the emergency services district.
Then what is this going to pay for? And I guess the other question I've got is that we're using, I don't know how long the term of these bonds are, but let's say 20-year debt to fund operations functionally. I mean, we're using bond proceeds to pay for engineering evaluations and administrative expenses of the agency.
Chair, Co-Chair Gomberg, Co-Chair Johnson, committee members, yet my understanding was that this would allow us the flexibility to use bond proceeds for, in particular, the two administrative positions in the event that that was needed, because it wasn't clear in the statute as it was written.
Mr. Bender.
Or if I may clarify, the bill itself does not change the seismic rehabilitation grant program and the parameters that are in place in order to determine eligibility for projects. What it does do is it provides another potential source of funding the agency's costs. This would be done only if the legislature approves a request by the agency to do so. So, for example, in your question of bond finance, if the legislature chooses not to support that, the program administration would need to continue to be financed by lottery funds.
Excuse me. Okay. All right. Why don't you guys stay there? I don't know if we're going to have any more questions. Anything else, Mr. Bender?
No, I don't believe so, unless there's
okay.
Anyone else who wants
Madam
to speak.
Chair.
Representative Nierman.
Along these same lines here, so the Oregon Constitution, and I'm reading from Article 11M in Oregon Constitution, and it says that to provide funds for the planning and implementation of seismic rehabilitation of public education buildings, including surveying and conducting engineering evaluations of the need for seismic rehabilitation. The bill just copies the Constitution there. So Section 5 in the bill says, plan and implement seismic rehabilitation includes A, surveying and conducting engineering evaluations of the need for seismic rehabilitation. That's copied right out of the Constitution. But then you have Section B also, paying the costs of personnel, advisors, equipment, supplies, and services. So aren't you kind of overstepping the bounds of the Constitution? In other words, the Constitution says you can have these bonds to do this, and you're saying the bill says you can have these bonds to do this and that.
Co-Chair Gomberg, Co-Chair Johnson, committee members, it certainly wasn't our intent to overstep the Constitution in any way. Really, I believe the intent was to give us some flexibility to use bond proceeds as well as lottery funds to fund primarily those administrative positions. So we did consult LFO. It was originally recommended by our bond counsel, LFO, DOJ, and moved forward with it after careful consideration, certainly not attempting to in any way circumvent the Constitution.
Yeah, and can we follow? It came out of legislative counsel, so somebody who's a lawyer, which I'm not, obviously produced this document. But that, to me, that I don't know, it looks to me like it's kind of a step around the Constitution. Thank you.
Okay. Colleagues, any other questions? All right. Do we have an LFO recommendation?
Yes, we would recommend that you move the bill to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, colleagues, any questions of Mr. Bender? Co-Chair Gomberg.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I'd move Senate Bill 1512 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, colleagues, you've heard Co-Chair Gomberg's motion. Are there any questions, any discussion, any objection? Representative Nierman objects, Representative Whitsitt objects, and Senator Hansel objects. Okay. So the motion carries, and we will need carriers to full.
Into both floors.
Full into both floors. We have any volunteers?
Interest. Otherwise, I'll take.
Okay, Representative Gomberg will go to the House floor and to full, and Senator Monroe, would you do it on the Senate side, please? Okay. All right, so we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1512, and we're now concluded with the work sessions. We'll open up an informational hearing on Oregon Business Development Department. This is Oregon's Unmanned Aerial Vehicles Initiative, and invite Ms. Swofford to come forward, and Mr. Bender, do you want to introduce us to the subject?
Yes. The informational meeting is a status report on SOAR Oregon. SOAR Oregon is an entity that is being funded in the budget this biennium with approximately $3 million of lottery funds. It is one of the Oregon Innovation Council initiatives, and it is designed to promote unmanned aerial systems companies here in the state of Oregon. The funding is a significant increase over the amount provided last biennium, where I believe it was about $900,000. The committee has asked for a report on progress by this entity.
Thank you. And Ms. Stafford, welcome. I know that the board chair is in the back of the room. Who's going to be responsible for the presentation today?
Co-chair Senator Johnson and Representative Gomberg, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Heather Stafford. I'm the Assistant Director of Innovation and Entrepreneurship at Oregon Business Development Department. And I will be just introducing our administration of the SOAR contract and how things work for Business Oregon and for the Oregon Innovation Council briefly. And then we'll call up Chuck Allen and Craig Latkin, board chair of SOAR, to speak after me about
Thank
about
you very much.
Progress.
So please begin.
So for a bit of background, and you have an itemized list of state investments in front of you and had been sent out to you prior to this. In the past 6 years, the state of Oregon has invested $7.8 million in the unmanned aerial systems industry since 2009. This is a very, very young industry. SOAR joined that investment in 2013. And the advantages that we saw that legislature and Oregon Innovation Council and many of the ranges and advocates of unmanned aerial systems saw was that Oregon is one of just 13 states that have an FAA-approved test ranges for commercial use. We have three in total, and this is run with the Pan-Pacific UAS test range complex, which involves several states in the Northwest, and we have three ranges of that complex. Oregon is also home to very established industry suppliers like Garmin, FLIR Systems, Northwest UAV. This isn't an industry that we're trying to jumpstart from scratch. We actually have a lot of advantages here, a lot of companies already successfully in this industry. The industry will grow. It's, as I said, it's a nascent industry where we have a chance to take a leadership position as we're very early in this. And as the commercialization of young companies and our test ranges grow, the hope was that our leadership capacity as the state of Oregon would grow as well. UAS Innovation supports jobs at test ranges in Pendleton, Tillamook, and Warm Springs. There's opportunities for specialization in each of those, where Pendleton is a public airport. There's commercial use. Precision agriculture is very big at that one. Tillamook, high altitude, off the coast, long distance flights. And in Warm Springs is tribal land, so it's private. Firefighting Center of Excellence is probably what they're working towards. So there's the ability to have a lot of diversity in test ranges, and we recognize this as a state very early on and invested heavily to build them out. A quote here from Pendleton Mayor Philip Hauk. We made a significant investment as a community in unmanned aerial systems, and we believe this industry is about to take off. We think there are going to be some real opportunities for Pendleton and Eastern Oregon that will pay dividends for the state. This is a reflection of just the level of local, state, private, public funding in a variety of areas that you'll see, you know, the Infrastructure Finance Authority, Strategic Reserve Fund money, and then we get to SOAR, which was created to and funded in this last biennium to support the operation costs of the ranges and then help support the industry as a whole and invest in young companies with promising technologies. So SOAR is a nonprofit economic development organization. It's a 501c6. It's created to foster growth in the UAS industry in Oregon. Its mission is to support the test ranges, to serve existing companies, and also to recruit new businesses. And I would say, in addition, to market the state of Oregon as a place to fly. It launched in 2013 in the 2013-15 session with a $900,000 in funding through the Oregon Innovation Council. The legislature opted to ramp that up in the 2015 and 17 to $3 million to support the larger and diverse infrastructure investments in the test ranges and industry as a whole. So business development, we administer the contract and scope of work for all Oregon Innovation Council initiatives. SOAR partners with Business Oregon and the three test ranges with the goal of growing jobs and companies in the state of Oregon. SOAR's contract was finalized with Business Oregon just last month, and it includes a detailed scope of work and performance metrics. But the top three performance metrics that they're being held accountable for are to market the test ranges and pay for staff that help those test ranges produce $550,000 in total revenue over the biennium, just from the three ranges combined, and then provide grants to unmanned aerial systems companies who have a 3-to-1 private match, and create or retain 20 jobs at the test ranges and at these young companies where they'll be making investments. Oregon Innovation Council's audit committee completes SOAR's quarterly performance reviews. Jobs numbers are calculated by Oregon Business Development Department every 6 months, and the audit and accountability committee reviews these performance measures and holds them accountable every quarter. And we do this for all initiatives. So that's a baseline of how we administer this, and I'm happy to entertain any questions that you might have before bringing SOAR.
Thank you, Representative Reed.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. As you know, you and I are the ex officio non-voting members of the Oregon Innovation Council, part of the legislature. One quick question on your handout, other than the typo in the first line. The $3 million was through the legislature, just to highlight that.
Yes.
Are the other pieces from Business Oregon and other sources within Business Oregon?
Yes, there were investments from our Infrastructure Finance Authority and also from the Governor's Strategic Reserve Fund.
Great. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. And you've made the declaration of potential conflict for both of us. Thank you. All right. Thank you very much, Ms. Stafford. If we could invite Mr. Allen and Mr. Ludkin to come forward, that'd be great.
Co-Chair Johnson, Co-Chair Gomberg, members of the committee, thank you very much for inviting us here today to present to you. I wish I'd seen Heather's slides earlier. I could have cut out 30% of my own. However, in the interest of time, if there's anything you want me to skip over, please tell me. I've got a very wide coverage of SOAR operations in here. Some of it may not be anything you're interested in hearing more about. SOAR was established in 2000. Well, we began establishing SOAR in 2012 with the intent of developing, promoting, expanding, and supporting the unmanned aerial systems, the UAS or drone industry in the state. We broadly define that to include any and all technologies, businesses that work either as platform builders, sensors builders, or in support of any of those types of companies.
May I stop you, Mr. Allen? I don't think you've identified yourself for the record. And while you're doing that, I don't think you need to read us the slides.
I normally won't.
Okay.
Just the mission statement.
Thank you.
I'm sorry. My name is Chuck Allen. I'm the executive director of SOAR Oregon.
My name is Craig Ludkin. I am the board president of SOAR Oregon.
SOAR has four staff, myself, John Stevens, our chief operations officer, Scott Kinney, who's responsible for business development and marketing, and Aileen Lennon, who provides social media support, business development support, and administration support for the team. We have a 12-member board. The details on the board are in attachment 6 of the report that I sent out in support of this presentation. Wanted to give you a little background just to refresh everybody's memory of why we are even doing this. The UAS industry is expected to be about a $14 billion industry in terms of economic value within the first 3 years of integration into the national airspace. That's expected to grow to $82 billion in the first 10 years and include an additional 104,000 jobs nationally. How this relates to Oregon, according to the industry study that everybody quotes, is about a half a billion in revenue and about 615 jobs over the first 10 years of integration into the national airspace. I'm not going to talk too much about the history here, but SOAR was established at the same time that the Vice President of Research at OSU, Dr. Rick Spinrad, was working with the University of Alaska Fairbanks in support of their application to the FAA to create a designated test site, one of the 6 in the nation. At the same time that was going on, the same people were involved in developing an organization called SOAR, which was expected to be an umbrella organization for the test ranges that would be created under the UAF test site mandate.
Let's just stop there for a second, because, and I apologize to the panel, I actually have perhaps more insight into this because I've spent an awful lot of time in it. When you talk about the oversight organization and the oversight nature of SOAR, could you talk a little bit about how you've reconciled the fact that we have 3 different models of test ranges? We have Pendleton, heavily supported by the municipality of Pendleton and with a lot of public money in it. We have a sovereign Indian nation, the test range at Warm Springs, and they have funding opportunities and governance issues that are distinguished by their unique sovereign status. And we have the test range at Tillamook that is largely private money. And I would like to have something on the record as to how you have reconciled the fact that each one of those endeavors intends to market themselves, intends to have some degree of autonomy, particularly the Tillamook range that has been in operation for 2 decades and is sending vehicles to the very edge of space even as we speak. Talk a little bit about the current status between the ranges and SOAR's initiatives.
Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee, you've covered much of it actually for me. The test site, we use test site and test range not interchangeably. Test site is a designation that's specific to the FAA to the 6 designated test sites in America, one of which is UAF. Our test ranges fall under the auspices of the UAF test site. As Co-Chair Johnson said, each one of them is very different in so many ways. We work very closely on a marketing level with both Pendleton and Warm Springs. I've got slides in there about this. Near Space Corporation, which is at Tillamook and drives that operation, has been in business for 20 years. They've been doing business with NASA, NOAA. They are currently flying a very high-value customer. I am told it's about a $2 million contract, and they keep much more to themselves because of business and competitive issues, which are more important to them, and we respect that. It is an interesting task because, on the one hand, we need to support these guys. On the other hand, they do want a degree of autonomy, which is actually fine with us. Our job is not to operate the ranges. Our job is to provide support, services, and resources to the ranges, some of which is funding, some of which is marketing. We work very closely with 2 of them in terms of support of their business development and approach to clients. We've worked with 5 clients of theirs, both at Pendleton and Warm Springs, over the last several months. And as I said, Near Space, they run their own ship. They do a good job. They've been running a long time, and they've brought in some significant customers on their own. We expect that will continue.
I'd like to point out one difference between the Oregon, Alaska, Hawaii test site complex that is different than the other 5 sites nationally. when you apply to the FAA as a test site, as we did some years ago, there is only one signatory. And consequently, that was decided at that time in conjunction with Dr. Spinrad and UAF, that signatory would be UAF.
Let's make sure that we know what everybody that's listening to this, because this is being broadcast, that they know what UAF means.
University of Alaska is UAF.
Thank you.
University of Alaska Fairbanks. So we had to build a slightly different operational construct to deal with the fact that we had Hawaii, three different test ranges in Oregon and the University of Alaska Fairbanks that will all be part of this complex. To do that, effectively, Dr. Spinrad set up, in conjunction with the UAF, a design of an operational management construct. A diagram is in your documents that we have supplied you, which has basically a board of directors, requirements for chief operating officers for each of the ranges and that kind of thing, and a position for SOAR and OSU, Oregon State University, to all be part of this overall governance. And that did not actually come to as much complete fruition as we all in Oregon would want. And that is one of the issues that we have. But it is unique to the Oregon, University of Alaska, and Hawaii situation. And to some degree has slowed down the ability to get things moving as quickly as we wanted.
Thank you. Mr. Allen, if you want to continue.
The way the test sites were set up by the FAA, they were created with something called public aircraft operations, which is a bureaucratically cumbersome set of rules. It's slowed down the ability of test range, test site, whatever you want to call it. We'll refer to them all collectively as test ranges. As their primary flight authorization, it slowed things down significantly. They also began issuing in 2014 what are known as Section 333 exemptions, which allow for commercial flights within certain guidelines, such as under 400 feet, 5 miles away from an airport, daytime, visual line of sight, things like that. But it also meant that some of the commercial work that could have been done at the test ranges could now be done under a 333. This all appears and, in fact, did dilute some of the business that could have gone to the ranges. But, in fact, we are now starting to see, and the other test ranges and test sites as well, the more serious vendors, manufacturers, are now starting to gravitate towards the ranges, which I'll cover later in the presentation. And we also have some of those coming to the state as well.
Mr. Allen, we have 15 minutes left, and I want to leave time at the end to talk about what your plan for sustainability is, because while the legislature has appropriated money for your operations now, that includes your operations, grants to the ranges, investments in companies, that money is not certain in the next cycle, and I'm curious to know about what your earned revenue opportunity plans are.
Then I'm going to skip through several slides here if you don't
mind.
That'd
be fine, because I think we're way down in the weeds with 333s, and there's only three of us in the room that know what you're talking about. So let's lift it back up to a little bit higher level.
And that's fine. As Heather mentioned, these are our primary objectives for 2015, 2017. We have numerous secondaries, which are included in the report that I circulated to you, but these are the top of the list.
And how will you differentiate on the earned income? You say produce $250,000 at the ranges. Let's take Tillamook, for example, that already has a robust book of business and is dealing with a $2 million customer right now. Does that count against the $250,000? That's their own earned income. How are you going to differentiate? How will you know what things SOAR was directly responsible for versus the very aggressive plans the Indians have to develop a niche market in firefighting and power line? How will you disaggregate who's responsible for the income?
That's a very difficult thing to do, quite frankly, because a lot of what we do is talking to the same people that those test sites are talking to. Firefighting Center of Excellence, we've been very involved with talking to the vendors, manufacturers, talking and working with VDOS, working with the Warm Springs Range, coming up with the marketing plans to help support the Firefighting Center of Excellence and similar activities out at Pendleton. So how do you determine then what part, and of course, as you know, the funding for the heads in those test ranges are funded through money that's been provided through SOAR. How do you actually put the dollar amount on what we did is very difficult to do. Our job is to promote these things, be involved with them enough that we're having an impact in the market overall. Some of it will be more directly attributable, some of it less so. With regards to Tillamook, we're looking forward. We're not looking backwards at the customer they already have. We're looking forward at customers they bring in from henceforth.
Okay, I just at least want to put a flag on this one because these are your performance metrics, and this will be part of the gauge that the legislature uses to know whether or not to continue to invest in SOAR. And while you identify it as a hard question, and I don't dispute that, this panel is looking for the answer. Not to be told it's a tough question, but I just would like to know how you're going to plan on doing that so that it's equitable.
Co-Chair Johnson, Co-Chair Gomberg, members of the committee, we recognize that. I only state that now because this is something we and the ranges both know we have to quantify.
Okay.
So it is a question that we have to answer for our operations and for effective presentation to the audit committee.
Thank you.
May I add one comment in terms
Please.
Of the strategic intent of SOAR? The intent of SOAR is not to govern what the ranges do. Each range has its own identity. They have their own attributes. They have their own physical attributes. They have their own commercial attributes. And we are intending to be supportive. We've also taken the view that we would like to try and consolidate as much of the common tasks amongst the ranges that each one would have to do individually. And there's a lot of technical stuff in there with the FAA that needs to be done. But we in no way want to tell the ranges, you know, how they should be constructing their business plans, who they should be marketing to, the nature or the subsegments of the UAS industry that they should approach. We want to be a resource for them to come, and we are funding certain operational capabilities for that through the heads that we're funding and safety officers and test range managers. But we are supportive of offering a broader umbrella of marketing capability without restricting their ability to do any of these items on their own. In fact, would be supportive if they do so. So it will continue to be something that we hope the industry becomes vibrant and successful because of that, but because of the nature of the things we are funding specifically within these ranges. You know, if a customer comes, as did Yamaha last week, come to Oregon to say, can we fly and where can we fly? And they visited Pendleton. You know, the fact
I didn't hear what you said. Yamaha came, they said, where can we fly? And then I didn't hear the piece
Yamaha
about Pendleton. Are they flying in Pendleton?
Not yet. They're actually flying in Washington. They would like to come down to Oregon. They have identified Pendleton as a really ideal place to fly. And so we had a good meeting. Mr. Porter was there. And it's an actually ideal classic situation of what we would like to facilitate. They would like to do some R&D, agricultural-based, using some existing technology that they are allowed to fly in Japan and everywhere else in the world except the United States. Pendleton is an ideal test range. We need to understand what it is they need in terms of operational capability to support that. When we fund heads and staff that provide some technical capability to the test ranges, but we don't control the marketing direction that they take, you know, there is some degree of success or failure that each individual test range will be generating based on their own initiatives and their own merits. And we don't intend at SOAR to oversee that. We wish to be a supportive resource for them to the extent they wish to use us.
Thank you. Please continue.
I'm going to briefly go through the elements that make up our operation. We have four primary activities in our statement of work. One is the UAS marketing program, which is designed to promote the state as a great resource, the test sites in the state, and I'm sorry, I'm skipping ahead. This is the UAS test range support, specifically what we are doing for the test ranges. It goes into detail. The statements of work, the complete details are in the packet as one of the attachments that I sent out to you. The second activity is grants and business development, which is, as it sounds, grants to industry in support of business development both within the state and external to the state to generate interest coming here. And we've had some very interesting conversations just in the last several days with one is, of course, Yamaha, and the other one is the largest manufacturer of UAS in Australia.
You heard some of the conversation that the committee had with the agency. Will you have objective criteria? Will the company have to come with certain work already accomplished? Will you be picking winners and losers based? I mean, one company gets to apply and they're funded, the other doesn't get funded. Will there be criteria that can be reviewed to know how SOAR's decision-making matrix works?
Yes, we actually have a decision-making matrix associated with the RFP we've put together. I did not include it in the packet, but I can send it out to all the members of the committee if you'd like to see
it. I would respectfully ask that you send it to the professional staff, Mr. Bender, and he can distribute it. Thank you.
The marketing program, as I said, is designed to leverage what we can for the state of Oregon. I will just point out that currently, when we monitor all social media and web traffic, Oregon is head and shoulders ahead of any of the test ranges or test sites in America in terms of the amount of activity we get. And we expect to expand this significantly now that we've been funded. Industry stakeholder collaboration refers to our interaction with the legislature, both at the state and federal levels. Two of us, John Stevens and myself, are on Representative Huffman's UAS steering committee, working committee. We are, as Heather said, a 501c6, which is a trade association. We have not leveraged that up to now. In this biennium, we do intend to do that, bring in membership, and provide fees for the services associated with that. The rest of this is really activities that we have undertaken, work done to date. I will go through this rather quickly, and please interrupt if you have any questions associated with any of these slides. We have already finalized and signed the Pendleton Range Labor Agreement and Memorandum of Agreement. We have the final reviews out both to Warm Springs and Near Space at Tillamook. I have a meeting with Don Sampson of Warm Springs out at the reservation on Friday. And yesterday, Near Space notified us that they're going to have their comments back to us within the next 2 days. We've done a lot of work both at Warm Springs and Pendleton in supporting range managers who come and go. They both use contractors to support their range, and they've had two of them in the last 6 months that John Stevens has worked to get oriented to the operation at Warm Springs. Pendleton, we filled the gap when their operator had no contractor support for a short period of time. I believe it was a couple of months. We've also worked with customer prospects at both Pendleton and Warm Springs. And to your earlier question, Madam Co-Chair, the Yamaha is a good example. Yamaha, that whole thing came through SOAR originally, and they were very interested in Pendleton. We met last week. Craig and I and Scott were both at the meeting here in Salem with them. John Stevens was up at Pendleton with them. That's going to get handed off to Pendleton. And anything that develops out of that will appear to be from Pendleton. But we were instrumental in setting the whole thing up in the first place. So, like I say, it's hard sometimes to figure out where the divisions are going to be. But we're more concerned with getting the business in there than necessarily taking credit for it. We continue to do ongoing support both with the Pan-Pacific UAS Test Range Complex, which is the nomenclature for the relationship with University of Alaska Fairbanks. You're going to see we frequently refer to Pendleton and Warm Springs in these slides. We don't get a lot of information from Near Space, but they are doing a lot. They're probably doing more than any other range. Their activities are business and competition sensitive, and they generally do not want to disclose them publicly, which we appreciate. And
they also do a considerable amount of defense contracting, which
correct.
I believe cannot be disclosed.
Correct. And even the stuff they do tell us, Much of it, well, most of it, we don't discuss beyond ourselves. We have been directly involved in generating, creating leadership in developing and refining documents that did not exist up at Alaska for flights in the early many, many months of their operation. Nobody could fly simply because the documentation didn't exist that would allow us to fly. John Stevens took leadership on this and spent his first several months at SOAR working on these documents, getting them in place. And had he not done that, we probably would still be in the same position we were in. So we've done a lot of background work that is not terribly visible. We've also put together internally a lot of documentation necessary for the ranges to operate, for them to select staff that's consistent across all the ranges. Whether they choose to use them or not is really up to them, but the range labor positions are very specific to a type of discipline that most of us are, including myself, are somewhat unfamiliar with. And a memorandum of agreement between SOAR and the ranges, specifically defining the services and responsibilities of SOAR to the ranges and how that all works. Business development and marketing is pretty much the same for both Pendleton and Warm Springs. We've worked very directly, hands-on, with both ranges, both test sites, in terms of what they're trying to do, how they want to present themselves. We're looking to develop a value proposition that is unique to each one of these operations, because that is what's going to distinguish them and Oregon from all the others. Because quite frankly, we have 13 test ranges around the country, and there's not much difference. You go out there, you fly. It's probably pretty safe.
Have they not, though, particularly the Indians, staked out their value proposition? I've seen their press releases. I think they're having a press availability either this week or next week announcing their spires of excellence. Was that generated by the tribe or by SOAR? Where'd that come from?
Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee, that was actually announced by Bend Television. We're going to be out there on Friday. We have worked very closely with their marketing person to help put this together. Although they've pulled it together on their own, we provide all the background support and the marketing assistance. This also generated the lead from the Australian company that now wants to come down and meet with us, meet with Warm Springs, to look at moving their entire operation from Washington State, testing in Nevada, directly to based in Portland and operating out of Warm Springs. So again, we're involved, but we're not involved, and we will be out there on Friday for that that Bend Television event.
I'd like to offer one important perspective I think the committee should be aware, is that the entire industry has been having a very difficult time figuring out where to allocate capital because of the nature of the changing rules of the FAA. The venture capital industry has had difficulty. The ability for other states to figure out how and the way necessary to invest in their test ranges, bigger organizations throughout technology. It has not been easy to identify what the rules and the roadmap is going to be. So I think it's important to remember that at the end of all this testing that needs to be done, there's no question that it is going to need to be tested. I think there's no question in our minds as what the end necessity is going to be for things over 55 pounds and probably over 35 pounds. We're not going to be, you know, developing this industry without substantial data, and that's going to need to be tested in a safe place. But at the end of the day, there are customers who need to figure out, you know, what they want to fly, what they need to fly, what they need to test, what they're allowed to test, you know, that kind of thing. And they are operating in as much gray area as the rest of us. So right now, there is as much difficulty amongst the customer base as to what they need to do as there is in trying to figure out what is appropriate in terms of a service offering for each one of the test ranges, both nationally and within the state of Oregon. So
thank you.
As that becomes clear, I think you'll see considerably more activity at the ranges. So.
Thank you. I would just ask you, Mr. Allen, to
wrap it up,
make any concluding remarks. I appreciate your very comprehensive portfolio of information for the committee. And I think given the new nature of SOAR and the fact that the legislature needs to continue to be informed about what's going on, we may ask you to come back and dedicate a whole meeting.
With pleasure.
But if you could make your concluding remarks.
What I'd like to conclude with really is in the last probably 30 to 45 days, we've seen much more activity across our test ranges than we've probably seen in the preceding 6 to 9 months. We've seen very serious interest from major players like Yamaha and the operation in Australia. Those kinds of things haven't been happening, but they are now. And to Craig's point, the manufacturers are starting to understand that this is a resource they need and should take advantage of because it has some unique capabilities, being what a test range is designed to be. It has special staff, it has special equipment, it's designed to do the kind of flight testing they need to do. It's now starting to happen. We expected this to happen 18 months ago, maybe even 24 months ago, and it's just taken that long. But we and the other test sites nationally are beginning to see serious traction coming down the road. And I'm hoping that the next time I sit before you, I have some serious numbers and serious customers that I can refer to.
On the industry side, as an example of the kind of things that we've seen in the last 2 weeks, an Eastern New York-based, Connecticut-based organization has come to us asking for a relatively small amount of funding on the order of $50,000 to $100,000 to come out of our industry grant program. And it's not a
who has, grant. Mr. Lockett, I didn't hear you.
I'm sorry?
Who has asked for $50,000 to $100,000?
A company based in Connecticut who is one of a pending subsidiary of one of the leading UAS service operations, which is also brand new because everything in this space is. They have identified the fact that there are a million of the smaller UASs, the DJIs that we all see in the media and what many of us identify as the smaller platforms. There's a million of those outstanding, and there is no service market, there's no refurbishment market, there's no repair market. They have said, could we come and establish a refurbishment operation here would be probably 15 to 25 staff. That would be great, you know, in terms of a relatively quick, relatively small investment that we would look to leverage with other investors that would be a quick 15 to 25 jobs, you know, probably $25 to $30 an hour. In which other types of services could grow. It's kind of like the eBay of drones. So we're seeing those types of things coming in. We're also very aware of existing service companies, software companies who have been waiting for funding from SOAR to come to its conclusion and said, when you get that, please let us know. So that has stacked up, and I would dare say that probably isn't remotely enough money for the demand we expect to see for things that could create probably a higher certainty of jobs in a sooner time frame that we might see because of the regulatory constraints, you know, through the test range complex, and you should be aware that those also exist.
Thank you. I think what we're going to be Representative Whitson.
I just wondered on your staff, that you have the staff salaries from their about $190,000 a year. Are they pilots? Are they what? Are they? What's the background for your staff salary?
Staff salaries are the four people I identified at the beginning of the presentation. Myself, John Stevens, who is a 20-year veteran in this particular type of work and a 20-year Marine veteran as well. And I probably got the numbers wrong because that doesn't add up to his age. But he's the specialist in the group with all the FAA background and experience. Mm-hmm. Scott Kinney, who is our business and marketing head, and the details of their salaries, by the way, are in the packet that I supplied to you, and then our admin and business development support and marketing support, social media support, which is Aileen Lennon.
But I would like to say that John Stevens' capability is extremely strong nationally. He is a unique resource. He is our highest paid employee by a considerable margin. If we didn't have his technical expertise, we wouldn't be where we are. And if we didn't have his expertise within SOAR Oregon, each of the individual test rangers themselves would have to outsource this expertise and probably do it individually. And it's an example of how we're trying to get the best result for the least amount of money by having that type of capability available to all ranges.
Thank you. We will invite you back again. I think what many of us are interested in is the return on investment. We have a track history of having invested ferociously in some of these new initiatives and, frankly, wasted a lot of money. And so when you come back, I think we're going to be very interested in seeing demonstrable return on investment. With that, colleagues, I will thank you for coming and making the effort. We will invite you back again. Colleagues, anything else for the good of the order? Mr. Bender, anything? We're adjourned.
Thank you.
Prepare yourself for Egypt.
Prepare yourself for Egypt.